Gentlemen, let us begin. I see that... We are missing an overhead light, so we shall have to generate more light down here. We are on Daf Zayin Amud Aleph, 7A, 7A2 in the English. 7A2. To recapitulate just generally, and I don't want to at all go into the material we were doing last time. Once is enough for some of this material. I think that you should have, and I have every reason to think that you did have, the sense after reading the last piece of Talmud that something funny is going on here. That our sense of the intuitive development of an idea was offended by the way in which the Gemara was progressing. Namely, we have assumed right from the start that a man must give a woman kiddushin. He must, among other things, give her kesef, a pruta of kesef, according to Beit Hillel, and he must give it to her. So he must give it to her. By the end of our last session, we saw that he doesn't have to give it to her, which, to say the least, is not exactly intuitive, beginning where we begin. So we then moved, I tried to put this in some logical context, to the extent that this is possible, and said that it looks to me like the only thing that I can see as an analogy here is in the world of money, in finance, in economics. That in fact, economics works sometimes the same way. That things happen that aren't necessarily intuitive. That money is either exchanged or not exchanged, and yet there seems to be deals that go on all the time. Sometimes those deals are made for prices that go down. Sometimes those deals are made for prices that go up. And the economic mind is able to conceive of lots of things that the rest of us usually don't think about. Not only that, frankly, it's not all that intuitive for many of us. Well, what we found ourselves in here was by implication a comparison between marriage and economics. Right? That's where we ended up, actually. We said that the laws of marriage are not as intuitive as you might think, that once you begin to think about these things, you can give somebody something by not giving them something, somebody else can give it to somebody else, and in effect it can be as if you gave it to a third party. All of those things were logically possible, or so it seemed, given the way Rava was developing the idea. And we said that it seems like this is something that goes on in economics too. Okay? Well, that's exactly where the Gemara then goes. 7A2, on the right side of the page, down toward the bottom. Itamar nami mishmei Rava. It is said also in the name of Rava. So here we have again another one of these teachings of Rava. The Rava has extrapolated and gone in all kinds of odd directions as a result of starting from some one place and then taking off from there. Rava says, V'chein le'inyan mamona. It is likewise the case in the area of economics. Huh. That's what we had said ourselves. Rava says that in fact these kinds of transactions, which are not particularly intuitive, but which in fact make sense if you press them, they function also in the world of economics. Okay? Now, of course, we should have always assumed this, because one of the things that's, in a way, I think, sort of percolating behind the scenes here as an idea that we can never really hold on to is the fact that marriage is dealt with economically. And right from the start, the way we began the Masechet was by saying that somebody has to pay something to somebody else. And our natural reaction to that is, gee, that seems like something you would do if you were buying a house or buying a horse, but buying a wife? It's just, if it makes sense, it's offensive. If it doesn't make sense, then something else is going on here. But what we see now is that if you extrapolate and if you do the kind of logic that Rava was doing in the laws of marriage, where he can give her something without giving her anything. Now, he says it's also true in the world of economics. It's also true in the world of economics. So again, we have here that there's a comparison between marriage law and economic law, which on the one hand is intellectually interesting. Morally, it's perplexing, because it seems like they really should be quite different. The way I've resolved that in the past usually is by saying that these transactions that take place are for the purpose of changing status. And that is why you have a transaction that takes place. Marriage is a change of status. There has to be some way, whatever way it is, of acknowledging that change of status. Two people are no longer in the same status as they were before something happens at a certain moment in time. Because of biblical verses, we see that there is an analogy again and again between the state of change of status in a purchase and the change of status in marriage. The moral, if I can call it moral issue, or the sort of intellectual issue here, is how could you say that? On the other hand, that's the way it is. And that is the way it is because of language. It doesn't mean that it's the same thing. It doesn't mean that this is a purchase. But then and again, sometimes it seems like it is a purchase. Or at least the laws are structured around the laws of purchases. Even though it, again, from time to time, we'll come back and we'll say, no, it's not a purchase. It's not a purchase. Okay? So he says here, "L'chein le'inyan mamona." It is also true in monetary transactions. Okay, now the Gemara goes on and says, "Utsricha." It was necessary for Rava to state both applications of these laws. That is to say, that this kind of reasoning functions both in the world of marital law and in the world of economic law. Why? The Iyashma'in in Kiddushin. Had we learned this only as far as marital law is concerned, that is to say that in marital law, sometimes you can give something to somebody without giving anything to anybody. Or no, you can give it to somebody, but not to the person you thought you were giving it. Right? So that was the conclusion we came to last time. Alright? And now he adds, it's also true in economic law. So if we had learned this only in marital law, we might have assumed it applies only there. Mishum daha itata nichala becholdehu. Why? Because even though it may be a stretch, this woman really wants to get married. It's an interesting piece of psychology here. That it could be that, you can stretch the law, and so the Gemara says, here's a place where we, in fact, want to stretch the law. Why? Because a woman wants to get married. She's much happier being married than not being married. That's what the Gemara is saying, okay? And therefore, the Gemara is really seeking ways to make that practical and possible, as you yourself articulated last time. What if he's in a city here and she's in a city there, and it's hard for them to make that transaction? It's a pre-modern reality. Okay? So in that case, since we know that a woman wants to get married, we want to make it easy for her. And therefore we go out on the limb and we allow certain things to happen and we push logic in certain directions, and we're willing to do that in marital law because there's a reason to do it. There's a justification for it. Kidereish Lakish. As Reish Lakish says, Dilma Reish Lakish. And here the quote is of Reish Lakish's maxim. It's a very famous maxim in the Talmud, which you will find sometimes on wedding contracts. Tav lemetav tandu mi lemetav armalu. It's a little piece of Aramaic poetry, which has become famous if you know Aramaic poetry. I'll say it again with a little bit of rhythm. Tav lemetav tandu mi lemetav armalu. You can hear the rhythm behind it. And it means it is better, tav, tov, lemetav is lashevet, to dwell. It is better to dwell. Tandu, du in Aramaic is the same as it is in Greek, or in Latin. Du is two. It is better to dwell as two, milametav armalu, than to dwell as an armala. In Hebrew, an almana. Armala in Aramaic is the equivalent of the Hebrew almana, and almana is a widow. So it no woman wants to either be a widow or to be like a widow, namely, to be single. And it is better, therefore, to dwell too than to dwell as a widow. Okay, and the way it works nicely in the Aramaic, you can hear, is tav lemetav tandu mi lemetav armalu. Okay, so that was Reish Lakish's famous statement, and to the extent that that is a maxim that reflects the social value of marriage, then we go to whatever degree we have to go to make it easy and possible to get married, even if we have to push the law in a certain direction. Okay? So, as a result of that, we could have understood that this would apply in the world of marriage, because marriage has a certain importance to it, a justification to go to the nth degree. But to buy a car? No, you don't really, believe it or not, you don't really need a color television. Heschel, my teacher, the late Dr. Rabbi Abraham Joshua Heschel, in his first great book, was called Man's Need for God. Everybody forgot that book because they remember God in Search of Man. That was the next one. But Man's Need for God, he writes this amazing, crazy thing. It was about needs, human needs. And he writes about the nature of our modern society where advertising creates needs. And keep that in mind, that most of the needs that we have are needs that we have learned to have because of advertising. We live in a capitalist economy where the economy works by us purchasing. It won't work if we don't purchase. What is the big interest now of our government? To put a little bit of extra money into a few people's pockets so that they will purchase. Right? The worst possible thing that could happen is not a dread disease, but it's not spending money. Dread disease we could live with. And not spending money is a disaster for everybody. Okay? So...
You know, it's interesting. This is a... We criticize that they're not saving, but yet we want people to spend.
Well, of course we want people to spend. So Heschel says, he says, do you really think, he's writing this in about 1956. He's writing this in about 1956 or 58 or so. He says, do you realize the crazy things that people are trying to convince us of, that we actually need a color television?
That's right.
Right?
Well, you don't need a color television.
What, Francis? You want a black and white television?
Yeah, that's fine.
Really?
Yeah.
I thought you were going to say, that's what I thought you were going to say. Color, forget it, HD.
What is high definition? I hear about it all the time.
Francis, you just look at the ads long enough and you will need it within 6 months.
You'll need it. Listen, my neighbors complain.
This is a need.
That I play the TV too loud. What is high definition? What is that?
So, now how did I get into needs? where was I?
Heschel.
Yeah, well, why did I go to Heschel with Mises?
Because of monetary transactions.
To spend the money.
The monetary transactions.
No, he said that advertising.
Yeah, well, there was a good reason for that. Well, it was fun anyway that we got into this. Yeah, no, it was to talk about needs. It was to talk about needs.
Contrasting the economic.
The need to buy a car.
Motives.
The question, correct. We need to have a car, right? To need economic needs, which we think are the supreme needs of our lives. For some reason, Reish Lakish thinks there are other needs that are really more important. Namely, at least this is put in terms of a woman, the woman needs to have a husband. Okay, that's much more important than economic needs. Or so we might say. So we might say. And therefore, we might say, as a result of that, if that, to the extent that that is true, we will go to, you know, to Outer Mongolia in the law, we will try to make the law possibly work here in order to make that happen. However, as far as color televisions go, we won't push it that far. We won't have the need to do that. Okay? So that's how the Gemara concludes. Gemara concludes. Right? Aval mamona. But for money, for color televisions, Emala, I will say that this kind of transaction, which is a sort of transaction that doesn't really seem to be a transaction, but is a transaction, it won't work in the normal economic sphere. Right? Because as a justification in the social sphere, in marriage, for marriage, all right, we'll push it there. But not in the economic sphere. Then it says, V'iyashma'ina mamona. But had Reish Lakish taught us this only in relation to money, right? He taught us in relation to two things. One was marriage, the other was money. Had he taught it to us only in relation to money, mishum de'itchahiv le'mechila, money is unique in that if somebody is owed something by someone else, he can always forgive the debt or forgive what is owed to him. He can say, it's very nice, you owe me $500, you don't have to give it to me. Okay? So there is an element in an economic transition of volition, which can always enter into the picture. Things can always change because one party can say, you don't have to pay me back. Okay? Aval kiddushin emala. But in the laws of marriage, that doesn't pertain, because once you make a decision in marriage, you can't go back on it. You can't decide the day after you get married, or even once you get committed to do the thing. Marriage is a sort of absolute that is more absolute than other things. Because it is a change of status that has ramifications on so many different levels in the life of a society, it in effect ends up being, believe it or not, more important than color televisions. Okay? And therefore, though we can use the law in one area, and though we can push it in one area, we might have thought we couldn't in another area. And therefore, he has to teach it to us in both places. We have to learn it in marital law, and we have to learn it that it applies also in the economic sphere. Okay? Questions or comments? Yes? Well, it's derived from, but we don't have to push it that far either. I mean, maybe yes, maybe no. It is derived from the guarantor. And you're right, of course. The fact is that he comes and says to us that both of those areas, the area both of marriage law and economics, are similar. But you might have thought otherwise. That's all we're saying, right? And that's a common thing in the Gemara, where the Gemara will, it'll go in two directions, and it'll say, you have to go in both those directions. Why? Because you might have thought this, or you might have thought that. And one of the things that it does when it brings that kind of an argument is that you learn a little bit about each separate sphere, how in fact it's somewhat different. And again, I come back to what I said at the beginning, that it seems to me that constantly percolating in our own reaction to these types of arguments has got to be the basic some level of discomfort with the analogy between marriage and an economic transaction. Right? It's just can't always be the same, because we know it's different and we want it to be different. And the fact that you might still compare the two, and they might be the two the same in many spheres, still there's that intuitive sense that it's got to be different. Okay? And I think that what's come out here is that that's true. You're right. And one of the things that the Gemara will do from time to time is to say, and by the way, since you thought they were exactly the same, I'll tell you they aren't exactly the same. Utsricha, you know, we needed to learn it here, we needed to learn it there, because you might have thought this and you might have thought of that, because they're not exactly the same. Once having said that, as a matter of fact, it builds up a certain amount of energy. It has a sort of built-in thrust. You let the cat out of the bag. You let the cat out of the bag about the economic side of marriage, it's going to stay out of the bag for a while. And the cat is going to walk around a little bit, as you will see in the Gemara that's coming up.
I want to see the picture of the way it happened. Let's say a third-party deal for the Kiddushin to arrange the marriage. But when they get under the chuppah, should he give her a ring? Or what he says, Arei at mikudeshet li be?
When they get under the chuppah?
Yeah.
Well, in their context, remember...
There was no chuppah. Definitely.
Correct. And that the Kiddushin was separated a year...
Correct.
Between the Kiddushin and the chuppah itself.
But today, we can arrange a third party...
We don't do any of this today.
No? No third party?
I never heard it in all my years. Which is not to say that somebody might not do it. Might be possible, but we just don't do it.
And,
they're totally
Mohar.
Different. That's they're nothing to do with it.
Nothing
to do with it.
You don't think it has influence?
No.
It's interesting. In this section, we're talking about trying to make it easier for a woman to get married. And previously, in terms of the vows that people say to each other, or the man says, woman, there that was very technical, and you wouldn't allow a marriage to come about unless the proper words were said from the man to the wife. So it's sort of a contrast with what we're doing here.
That's a tension. But remember, even in that discussion, we finally came to the conclusion that if you didn't say anything, you could still get married,
right,
as long as both parties were equally aware of the fact that that's what was going on. So there's a tension here. The tension is between the structure, and the structure which is often derived from a biblical source, and something which is beyond the structure. There is I don't even know what I should call it, a concept, but something like a concept anyway, and there's a real tension between the two, and sometimes sometimes a tension breaks down, but often they live in a tension with each other. I think you're right.
On helping the two sides to get together, let us take, for example, the question of distance of location between the groom and the bride. I would speculate that the dowry was not the main, but one of the reasons for it.
For what?
For helping them to get together in a physical term, rather, in a non-physical term. In other words,
there's no doubt that the economic side of marriage, if that's what's really implied by the dowry here, the economic side of marriage was then and has been, although it sort of comes and goes in terms of its primary importance, is very important. Sometimes it manifests itself in terms of a dowry. Sometimes it manifests itself in terms of security. That is a dimension of the change of status. And it's a desirable dimension. That's true. Anybody else? Okay. We go on. Now, with this background, you have to keep a good sense of humor. See where we're going to go now. Amar Rava, more Rava. Rava, this is really, Rava is feeling his oats. He is the hero of so much of this Gemara. By the way, I visited his grave once, what was supposed to be his grave. He's buried right outside of Tzfat, or so it is said that he's buried right outside of Tzfat. I had heard that and decided to track it down. And not too far away is Abaya. So Abaya and Rava. I'm a little under the weather, so I don't have a loud voice. Abaya and Rava are both buried in the same neighborhood outside of Tzfat. I don't really know whether there's any truth to this at all, because as far as I know, they lived in Babylonia, and I don't know anything about them coming to the land of Israel to either to live for any permanent period of time or surely to be buried. But that having been said, there can be all kinds of religious traditions about people that you love are buried, you know, around the corner. And where better to bury somebody like Rava than outside of Tzfat? So it's probably Mekubalim who were the sources of these traditions. And I went into his, it's like a cave. I went to the cave and I sat on his grave. I said, "No, give me some insight into these arguments." It's very dark inside there. And my family took a picture of me. I said, "I want you to take a picture of me sitting on Rava's grave because I don't want to forget it." And the picture actually came out very good. And one of the reasons is because it was a flash. It was the only time I was able to see anything. So it was much better in the picture than it was in real life because you couldn't see anything inside there. It was just sort of groping around. And people would come in, people had come in, and no one else was there when I was there. It's a little bit off the beaten path, to say the least. They would light Yahrzeit candles. They'd light Yahrzeit lamps, Israeli Yahrzeit lamps that are in metal, metal encased lamps. So I have a warm spot in my heart for Rava, and for many reasons. So listen to Rava now. Rava says, "Hitkadshi li lechetzi." A man says to a woman, "Betroth half of me." Now that's an interesting thought. Right? He wants the woman to marry one half of him. Okay? Mikudeshet.
Right side, it's, left side?
She's married. I would have said the good side. As opposed to the bad side, alright? If you're going to marry half a person, you might as well marry the half that you want. There's usually more in the bargain than that. Okay, so then you could say afterwards, you know, the other side I didn't marry, please go away. When you want to be nice, you come and that's the half I married, right? So it's a completely bizarre idea. But what does the Gemara say? Mekudeshet. Mekudeshet. Alright? Chetzyech mekudeshet li. So this was where he says to her that half of me will be married to you. That's a kosher marriage. Then it says, Chetzyech mekudeshet li. How about turn around? He says to her, half of you will be married to me. Eina mekudeshet. It's not a marriage. All right.
No notes.
All right. So, of course, look at the Gemara. Amar le Abaya le Rava. Abaya says to Rava, "Maishna chetzyech mekudeshet li, the eina mekudeshet." What is the difference between one half where you said, where he says to her, "Chetzyech, half of you is married to me, eina mekudeshet. This is not a marriage." Isha amar rachmana velo chatzi isha. The Torah says, "Vayikach la isha." Right? He shall take for himself a woman.
Can't take half.
You can't take half a woman. If it says, all right. So that makes sense. It makes sense, all right?
Pretty good. All right?
But, hachinami ish amarachmana velo chatzi ish. But the Torah also says, The Torah says, Vayikach ish isha. Right? Vayikach ish isha. A man shall take a woman. So, all right, I understand it says a woman, so not half a woman. But it also says ish, a man. So not half a man. So here's Abaye is, of course, arguing, how could you say it make a difference for the man and the woman? Right? You can't. Even if you were going to do it because you had whatever reason, scripture. The scripture says ish and isha. It doesn't say chatzi isha, chatzi isha. A half a man or half a woman. Amar lehe, Rav answers Abaye, hachi hashta. Hachi hashta means ho, 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 ho. It's one of those kinds of answers. Ho, 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 ho. Don't you remember? You fell into my trap. Right? You fell into the trap. Hatan ita tlevei tre lo chazya. In the case of half a woman, it's not permissible. A man is not allowed to marry half a woman, okay? But the truth is the other way around. Ela gavra milo chazi levetre. Can't a man be married to two? That's an interesting answer, because according to the Bible, polygamy is permissible. And in fact, if a man marries two wives, what does each wife get?
Half
a husband. All right? That's why polygamy's no good. That's the problem with polygamy. All right? That's the reality. Okay? Yeah. And I'm glad that Rava came out that way, really. And in fact, he is reflecting the difference of the structure of the law between this is polygamy and not polyandry. You know, it can go one way, but it can't go the other way. Okay? So that is why he formulates the law in that fashion, that it can be understood as far as you can have half a man, but you can't have half a woman. Okay? Now, of course, what that would mean practically is that once polygamy becomes illegal, as it is in Jewish law, then you can no longer say the half a man side. Okay, because today, since the Takanav Rabbeinu Gershom in the 10th century, it is prohibited to marry more than one wife. In light of that, it would now be prohibited to say chetzyech mikudeshetli. Mikudeshet ad lechetzy. Right? It would no longer be permissible to do that. Because all of this, everything that he said is based on the reality of polygamy as a legal arrangement.
So it started here.
What started here?
Against polygamy.
Maybe.
But it started in Europe.
Okay. Now Marzutra comes and objects to Rava's ruling on the basis of a baraita. Amar le Marzutra berei de Rav Mari le Ravina. Marzutra, the son of Rav Mari, said to Rabbi Ravina. Here the English is good. Why has Rava ruled that Kiddushin is invalid when a man betroths half a woman? V'nif shetula kiddushi bechula. In such a case, the Kiddushin should spread through all of her. Namely, if you buy, let's say you intend to buy a whole chicken, and yet you buy one piece of the chicken, okay? Truth is, if you paid enough money, you could take the whole chicken. All right, you can lay claim to the whole chicken. Why? Because unless you separate the piece is part of the whole. And so you could argue similarly here that a piece is part of the whole. And here's the example that you go. Milo Tanya, is it not taught in a Baraita Ha'omer Ragla Shel Zo Ula? If a man is, an owner of an animal is consecrating that animal as a burnt offering, okay, and he says, Ragla shel zo ola. The leg of this animal is a burnt offering. Tehe kula ola. The whole animal becomes a burnt offering. Why? Because you can't separate the leg from the animal. Can't pull an animal's leg off. Okay? So the assumption here is that sometimes people make statements which are partial statements, and their intent is for more than what they actually say. And some of these things may be euphemistically referred to or mistakenly referred to. But anyway, we assume that when a person says that I am consecrating the leg of this animal, he means I'm consecrating the whole animal. Okay? The afilu lamanda mar ein kula ola. And even according to the one who maintains, as you would imagine, there's another point of view here who says that, no, if you just say the leg is consecrated, then you've got a problem on your hands because you have a leg that's consecrated and not the rest of an animal that's consecrated. And if you have two sides of the animal, then you have problems because once you consecrate an animal, you're not allowed to derive any benefit from the animal. And among that benefit would be the benefit of shechting the animal. Right? Because you would want to shecht the animal. But once you can't derive benefit from the animal if it's an animal that's owned by the Kodesh, owned by the temple. Okay? So here you got a logical problem that you have to do. Hani milehecha de mikdash davar she'ein haneshamat luyaba. This is only when the animal's owner consecrated a non-vital limb. That is to say, if somebody were to maintain that if I say I am dedicating just this limb of the animal, that in fact it means just this limb, that point of view, that would pertain, that person who has that point of view says that it applies only where the limb is a non-vital limb. But if he were to consecrate something where the life of the animal, in fact, is dependent upon that thing, an animal can get along without a leg, right? But he can't get along without a heart, without a lung, okay? In that case, havya kula ola. In those cases where he is to dedicate just a part of the animal, if it's an essential part of the animal, in that case he's dedicating the whole animal. So here, in terms of a person, you can't divide a person. A person is a whole person. And even if you say a part of the person, then a part should be good enough for the whole person. A part should be equal to the whole. Just as the part of an animal is equal to the whole animal. Okay? Well, the Gemara says, Mi dame, is the case of Kiddushin comparable to the case of consecration? Now here, just the formulation itself is important, because again and again now, where we see these analogies made, I think that the intuitive sense is, how can you compare the woman to a sacrifice? Right? And of course, the Gemara will end up in the same place, maybe not in a direct line, but it'll end up in that place anyway. It's just midame. How could you compare the two? How can you compare the two? Not the way we would say, well, a woman is not an animal to be consecrated. That's not the way the Gemara will do it. It'll do it in a more classic fashion. Hatam behema. There, the object of consecration is an animal. And the man who consecrated owns it entirely. Hachadat acheret. Right? There, as far as a woman is concerned, a woman has a da'at, a mind which an animal doesn't have. And you can perhaps say that a part of an animal is equal to a whole animal, but a part of a person is not equal to a whole person. Because a person has a mind, and a person can decide with that mind. A person has to have a will. The will has to be agreeable to this. And therefore, you cannot make the assumption that one part of a person is the whole person. Because ultimately, the person is centralized in the person's will, and the person will decide however that person wants to decide. And therefore, you cannot separate a person into two parts. Okay? Now, that's also important, because as we saw again and again here, that though there is a monetary transaction, the notion of will is crucial to this transaction. And that in no way should be taken for granted in marriage law. We saw when we compared this to other systems, the Greek, the Roman systems of marital law that were contemporaneous with the Talmudic system, it didn't function that way at all. A woman was never asked what she thought in the matter. She was instead given away by either a brother or a father. In Talmudic law, it's possible to give away by a woman away by a father if she's a minor. Even then, it's conditionally. It's certainly not possible to do with someone who is not a minor. Anyone who has reached majority has a will. And that's an interesting translation. That's how the Arts Code translated da'at. It's probably not the best translation, because da'at means a mind. If a person has a mind, and a person has the right to refuse a transaction, you cannot generalize from part of a transaction to a whole transaction. In fact, the mind unifies the person as a totality. Okay? All right. So the Gemara now comes and finds what it hopes will be a more accurate analogy to the case, to Rava's case. Ha la damya ela la hadi amar Rabbi Yochanan. The case of Kiddushin is comparable to this limited case which we learn about Rabbi Yochanan. Behema shel shnei shutafim. If an animal is owned by two partners. Here we're back to the sacrificial law. Animal is owned by two partners. Higdish chetzia. One partner consecrates half of it. That's an interesting problem. What do you do then? Okay, one partner consecrates one half of the animal.
You need the both of them to consecrate the whole animal.
Correct, but you don't get it. All right. One of them consecrates it. V'chazar ulekacha v'higdisha. He then returns and purchases the other half, and he consecrates the second half as well. Okay? So in a later transaction, he buys out his partner, so he now owns the whole animal. Or at least he owns the second half. Okay? In fact, he's consecrated one half an animal.
He owned.
Yeah, but can you consecrate half an animal?
He owned half.
All right. He actually owned half the animal. And it's not the same case of part is equal to the whole. We were arguing just before. A leg is equal to the whole of the animal. Or a vital part is equal to the whole of the animal. Here, if two partners own it, in fact, it's as if one partner owns one half, the other partner owns the other half. So, on the one hand, he consecrated the one half, then he has the opportunity later on to consecrate the other half. But it's two separate transactions. He hasn't waited until he's owned the whole animal to consecrate the animal. That would be different. But he's consecrated one half, and then he's consecrated the other half. Okay? The chazar lekacha v'higdisha. Kedosha ve'ena kreva. The animal is indeed consecrated, but it cannot be brought as a sacrifice on the altar. There's something wrong with this consecration. Right? You can't do it that way. Why? Because you can't do half of a thing. Right? You really can't do half of a thing here. Temura, he creates a temura, temurato keotseba, and the temura, if you have an animal that is consecrated, and you try to substitute an animal for that animal, that substitution also becomes consecrated. In fact, you can't substitute. And by trying to substitute, you know, there's a desire to do that, because once an animal is consecrated, given to the temple, you can't use it anymore. So, and it may have been your good cow, let's say. That was your best cow. So you say, well, I'll give another cow in place of the best cow. So you say, okay, go in here. You take this cow in place of that cow. Or you lost twice. Not only did you lose once, you lost twice. Because the moment that you try to substitute an animal for an animal that has already been given to Kodesh, that animal automatically becomes Kodesh. Obviously, it's obvious why you have such a law. It's to discourage such transactions. Okay? It's to discourage people from changing their mind once they give a gift to charity, in effect. Once you make a gift to charity, you've got to carry through on that gift, and you can't change it in any way that may suit your interest. Right? It's beyond you once you've made that gift. So that's the law of the Tamura. So in this case, Tamura ta kiotseba, if you were to try and substitute an animal, indeed you have the problem of substitution. That is to say, the animal itself also becomes sort of kodesh, but it can't be used as an offering. It's in the same sort of never land.
You can't use it, it's not good for offering.
It's not good for anything.
It's either.
It is a total loss. This kind of a situation is what you call a total loss, because you can't use it for an olah, you can't use it for anything. What?
Who is responsible to feed it?
That's a question what you do with such total losses. You should not necessarily think that anybody is responsible to feed the animal.
No.
You may want to feed the animal. I'm telling you, not telling you that you can't feed the animal, but what if you don't want to feed the animal? Right? It may be possible to not feed the animal. It may be possible. Okay? Now, go a little bit further with Rabbi Yochanan's ruling. Shma mina tlat. Learn from this three things. Shma mina bale chayim nidachim. From this it can be inferred that living things may become permanently rejected from the altar. That is to say, when something becomes ineligible to be used as a korban, as a sacrifice, it's permanently ineligible. Ushma mina dechui me'ikar have dechui. And learn also, it can be inferred from this, that rejection at the time of initial consecration qualifies as true rejection. Ushma mina yesh dechui bedamim. And it can be inferred from this that permanent rejection may befall something that has only monetary sanctity. None of these things, I think, is too crucial for us. Okay? Now, having established that a man cannot betroth half a woman, Rava now proceeds with a series of related inquiries. By Rava. Okay? We're still with Rava. Right? So he's established a number of principles, and it keeps going on from principle to principle. Chetz yech b'chatzi pruta. Let half of you be betrothed to me with half a pruta. V'chetz yech b'chatzi pruta. And the other half with another half a pruta. Mahu. Now, we had learned that you have to marry a woman by giving her one pruta. Okay? And we have now learned that you can't marry half of her. But what if you marry her in a stepped transaction? 50 cents now and 50 cents later. You take 50 cents today, you know, in 1 minute, and 50 cents 5 minutes later.
It's a down payment.
It's a down payment, okay? Again, he's pushing the envelope. He's pushing the envelope. He came up with an intriguing idea here. It was an intriguing idea. He said, it's not permissible. And now he's trying to see if he can figure out a way to make it permissible. Okay? So, half and half. Gives half a pruta to one half and half a pruta to the other half. Or do we say that since the Mishnah says you have to have kiddushin with one pruta, it has to be one pruta for the total thing once and for all, now and then?
Okay? Sounds like you shouldn't pay you Tuesday for a hamburger today.
Maybe it's a second. Maybe it's a minute. We don't know. Wait, not yet. Let's see where we're going with this. Mahu. All right, question is asked. Now, Rava will try to answer this. Since he said to her, half a pruta, he has split his declaration in two, intending to betroth the two halves of her separately. Oh, Dilma Moneva Holech. Perhaps he's merely counting out the money to her in half pruta units. In other words, he's under the chuppah and he says, okay, with this half a pruta, I take half of you, and with that half a pruta, I take the other half. So that this whole way of formulating things is simply a way of talking. It's a way of getting to the point. Some people, you know, are slow to get to the point. Or some people are cute. You know, they like to do it in a way that's fun or funny. They like to make a joke. So the guy says, I'm half of this half and half of that half. But of course, what does he mean? He really means the whole thing, and it's just a way of getting to the point. That's the second possibility. Or, by formulating it in such a way, are we in fact dividing a person into two? And by the very fact of dividing the person into two, it's not a permissible transaction. Rather than goes down one of the roads that he set out for us, the second road, if you will say that in this case the man is counting out the money, or he's saying, half 50 cents gets me one half of you and the other 50 cents, bingo, gets me the other half of you. If that's what it means to say half a pruta for one half and half a pruta for the other half, cave in the amarla bifruta ufruta. Do we say that since he said to her, paskala milte, become betrothed to me with a pruta now and a pruta later, he intends to split his declaration in two, not realizing that a woman cannot betroth half at a time? O Dilma, Dilma kol biyome moneva holech, or perhaps we should argue that he attempts to complete the kiddushin in one day, and he's merely counting out the money, intending to perform a single act of kiddushin. In the latter case, it would be wrong. That's what we said. Rava now goes on. He's not finished. Im timtze lomar kol biyome moneva holechu. If in light of the last thing that he said, that the person is really just going to complete it. He's going on with this. He's going to go on with it all day, maybe. And that's the way he's approaching it. Chetzyech bifruta hayom v'chetzyech bifruta lamachar mahu. All right, if you say time is relevant, that was your first reaction. You're going to do half of it now and half of it next year? Is that... So he's got to get down to the time issue. If you say that this is just a way of doing things, and you're just dividing it out, and you're going to proceed and complete the transaction, what does it mean to do that? When? Next year? Next month? Next day? Next minute? Okay? So the way he formulates it here is, chetzech b'pruta hayom, chetzech b'pruta lemachar, right? Half of you I'm taking with a pruta today, and half tomorrow. Is that okay? Kev and the Amala Lamachar Paska. Do we say that since he said tomorrow, Paska, he divides the whole thing now? Right? Now we're dividing. Odil Mahachi Kamarla. Or maybe what he's really saying to her is, Kiddushin Matchul Mehaidne. The Kiddushin is starting now. Umigmar lo nigmaru ad lamachar, and it won't be over till tomorrow. What did somebody say to me? What do they call this? This is a Polish wedding. What is a Polish wedding? Somebody told me about. Is a wedding that gets started and just keeps going. Is that a Polish wedding? Jewish wedding. It's on the installment plan. Correct. Exactly.
In my city, it takes a week.
In your city, it takes a week.
South of my city.
South of your city, it takes a week. Good. Well, a Jewish wedding, in truth, is sort of like that. I mean, we have a Sheva Brachot. We have a 7 days of celebration of the wedding. But, in fact, the wedding is completed then and there under the chuppah. Okay? But it could be that lo nigmaru ad lamachar, that when you set this thing up, it just doesn't matter. As long as you're setting it up as a transaction to be completed, and the very way you set it up is that you're just taking your time, but you're going to do it. Do we consider that to be a whole woman or a half a woman? Pascha or lo pascha? Did we divide this lady up in half, or did we didn't divide her up in half? The English here keep saying dividing the money up in half. I would translate it differently. I would say, are we dividing the lady up in half? Because that was really the issue. It was chatzi isha. Question is this chatzi isha or is this not chatzi isha? Okay?
How do you propose dividing this lady in half?
It's a manner of speaking, Francis.
I know.
It's the method of dividing. The question is, if you deal, a lot of people deal with women as half people. Ask Hillary Clinton. Did you hear
ask
that?
Me.
Did, ask
me.
She went on television last night and all day today, saying, you don't deal with me the same way you deal with everybody else. And I'm going to show you that you deal with me differently. You know, you deal with me as half a person.
She's right.
All right. And she was trying to make that point. You know, she was trying to make that point. And it was an interesting point. It's a very important point. Okay? That's the point that we're talking about here. Half a person... You know what half a person means. It means is what Hillary Clinton meant. That's what she was talking about.
It means they're putting her down.
Exactly. Exactly. Okay?
May I ask,
yes, sir.
Could this be read more clearly in terms of a commercial transactions where the object involved could be easily divided? For example, somebody, and this happens, often happens in my business, somebody would say, no, I like those 10 acres of land you have. How much would you sell it to me? He goes, yeah. How much? $10,000. So a guy sends in, let's say, an order, or he sends the guy with the message of the money. Here's $5,000. I just bought 5 of your acres. Well, he didn't offer him a half of the parcel. They offered him the full parcel. Mm-hmm. Now, if a guy would say, $10,000, that's a lot of money. I only have $5,000. If I give you half the amount of money, would you sell me half the land? It's up to the woman to make up her own mind, yes or no. If, on the other hand, he said, I'm giving you half, now half of your property belongs to me, I think we would say that, in commercially speaking, this would not be a valid transaction. He never made that offer to you. He offered it as a whole, as an entity.
Mm-hmm.
And similarly, mm-hmm. if somebody says, well, it's $10,000 for the 10 acres, the guy says, he sends him a check for $5,000, he says, I'm giving you half down, and I'll give you the rest at a later date. The land belongs to me.
But there is no closing until you...
Well,
you can put installment, but if there is no closing, it doesn't matter.
Well, it's an open question, really, because maybe the guy, when he offered it, did not say, you know, you have a lot of technical people. You know, he'll say, well, you didn't say it had to be paid in advance.
Mm-hmm.
So I understood that, you know, I'm agreeing to your offer, and I'm paying you in the way mm-hmm. I can. So mm-hmm. these are kind of analogies
correct.
To real life.
These are all,
issues.
And the question is, whether, even given the more, let's say, the more likely analogy to marriage, whether it's a valid analogy to marriage, whether you can go there, whether that's a permissible direction to go in.
I mean, it seems obvious that it's an absurd analogy, but what I don't understand is why they're going there, because earlier on, if I understood the text, it was arbitrary how much money by which a woman could be taken as a wife. One purta was enough. So here he's going to give one purta and later another. So,
well, one half a purta.
Yeah, but then...
It changes.
Well, then
oh, yeah, you're right.
In this one of the
this
paragraphs,
one, correct,
he bumps it up. It doesn't
right.
matter. But the point is, if there's no... the amount of money isn't required, right? The only issue here is if she can be divided or not.
That's correct.
But then why do they bother if they've already spelled out that the amount of money doesn't matter? Why do they? Why is there a price that he's trying to beat?
Because there's it's an interesting way of saying that you can't be divided. Right? That's ultimately the purpose of it. It's to come at it from several different directions and either directly come to that conclusion or indirectly come to that conclusion. And it certainly, as far as the reader goes, you already came to that conclusion in all likelihood. You want to come to that conclusion, it's necessary. And this kind of reasoning may get you there or may not get you there. Some of it is successful and some of it's unsuccessful. As you'll see now, for example, some of it, you know, we're sort of going back and forth here, but look where it comes out. Where did we get to here? Yishlemachila Migmar Lemachar. Down in the 7b1, Shnech Hatzayayach Bifruta. That's it. That's the Fruta. If he says, let both halves of you betroth to me with a single Pruta. Okay? So he's now talking about two halves, and he's got one pruta. Hacha vadai bechad zimna kamarla. Do we say here, certainly the kedushin is valid, since he's saying to her that both halves have become betrothed to him at once, at the same time, and at the same time. O dilma eini shan mitkadeshet lechatza in klau. Or do we say that you just simply cannot make those analogies whatsoever? And in no case that you could possibly conceive of, can you allow for the possibility that a woman could be thought of as the half? Right? Interestingly enough, the Gemara comes to the conclusion, teku. We have no answer for that. We have no answer for that. So that given the kinds of questions that were raised, you eventually get no answers to them. You get no answers. So it seems to me that the value of the questioning is to really just take us along a certain road. In a way, all of this reinforces the first conclusion that Rava came to, which is that you cannot make kiddushin with half a person. The second issue then of the da'at being a crucial issue, that was also relevant. And then none of these other things really went anywhere. They didn't go anywhere. They were sort of interesting thought questions, which came out of the original conclusion that you can't divide the woman in half. And in fact, I think that's what we're left with. We're left more or less with where we started. Because we can raise these other problems, but we can't answer them as abstract questions.
Didn't Rava earlier? Rava's the one who brought the whole.
Rava's. The whole sugya is Rava's.
Yeah. Okay. So originally he was not speaking about dividing someone physically. He was talking about the man could actually betroth half of himself because. Meaning he has the right to marry a second wife. The woman can't divide herself, not literally, but figuratively, because she doesn't have that right. Now he's actually talking about dividing the woman. So he's kind of gotten off.
Well, he's trying to. No, he's having a good time.
He's having a good time.
He's having a good time.
Well, we're talking about half a woman.
Frankly. If some commentator could just come up with the analogy to this type of argument, it would fly very well in today's news. Because the idea of treating a woman as half a woman is really, you know, what made the news today. That was really the issue. And you know, to what extent can you deal with it with a little bit of humor? To what extent can you deal with it as an abstract problem, as a moral problem? To what extent do you deal with it by analogy? To what extent do you not deal with it? I think you're seeing them go through that process. And part of the process is the process of the dialectic of fun in the classroom, too. And it's also a male classroom, where I'm sure this is especially a lot of fun.
So it's an affront. To me, I view it as an affront to a lot of fundamental Jewish values. And the reason that I say that is...
What is the it?
The idea of the division. And the reason that I say that is the thing that's said to be unique about humans are that they're made in God's image. So the notion of a half of God's image is so troubling, so fundamentally troubling as an idea, as to be simply inconceivable outside of an economic analogy. And I think it really highlights the difference between economics and humans, that in economics we can always divide something in half, in terms of dealing with value or however we want to, because we have to deal with the realities of that kind of transaction. But I think it reinforces the integrity of the wholeness of the human. And the reason we got into this was really because of polygamy. And
that's exactly right.
Polygamy that then jumps out at you as the thing that's unnatural. Because it forces you into this notion that a man is capable of being divided in half, which means that he loses his integrity and loses his, that sense of wholeness. So, you know, my interpretation is that the conclusion is this just shows polygamy for men is absurd. You know, is an affront to
I could not agree more. And I think that the way you get there is an interesting path, but I think that that's where you're going. Or at least that's one of the places that you're going, undoubtedly.
I guess I'm sort of reading this and thinking about something we learned early on in reading it in a different way, which is that we learned, I guess, from Maimonides that originally, marriage was like the Wild West. You grabbed somebody and you
took it to your
got married. No laws, no rules. You know, just find somebody in the marketplace. Then along comes the Torah and says, forget that. We're going to be pretty strict. You know, we're going to have laws and rules. Kesef, shtar, and bia, that's it. Very strict. And this is all playful, yeah, but it's also we're at a level here of talking about marriage where it's pretty clear that they're trying to make it a much easier concept. It's important that there be marriage, and it's become pretty easy. We're even talking about not really half a woman, because these last relatives forget there's no such thing as half a woman. What there is here is facilitating a marriage of a woman in two parts, which is really, so maybe he can't afford to do it all at once. Mm-hmm. Maybe it's, we have all these financial analogies, but this last part is all about marrying a woman.
Correct.
Can I do it
different
in two
ways.
Parts? Do I have to do it in one day in two parts? Can I do it over time? We're going to be in different parts of the world. Maybe I just can't forget that. I think you said that Rava is living in 325. So this is exactly the time of the Edict of Constantine. Constantinople has become the world. Rome is pretty much in another 100 years it's finished. Even now the center of the world has moved much closer to where we are all living. And you can imagine that when they built Constantinople, the commercial world, the traveling, involvement, and I don't know whether Jews were being wiped out. I can't remember what the approach was, but so which would explain why they would be encouraging marriage. Or the world was, in a way, for Jews the way it is today, where it's open and tolerated, and Jews are open.
Somewhere in between the two extremes that you're.
But I mean, I think that they're trying to say we need to encourage marriage. Mm-hmm. Two is better than one. And we are going to have rules, and it's going to be holy, let's not get too crazy about that.
Very nice. Very good. Very good. Yes.
You mentioned a time ago, I think the question came up about polygamy. And, you know, I mean, if polygamy was true, then you could divide a man in more than one, two pieces, three pieces, four pieces. I don't think there was any limit on the number of wives or wives that men could have. But you, if I understood correctly, some rabbi in the 10th century wrote a tract against polygamy. Was that drawn from this logic?
I have never read the Takanah of Rabbeinu Gershom, so I don't know the answer to that question. I don't know exactly what he bases it on. What I do know is that the Takanah, it's called the Takanah of Rabbeinu Gershom, once he does issue that, it becomes the law of all the lands to all the lands who are exposed to it, which is to say, if Rabbeinu Gershom's law penetrated into a particular Jewish community, it was followed. There was no question about it. I'm sure the reason for that is that there was a social reality. It was welcome.
But this would be an authority for that to
know. I honestly don't know whether he uses this material in his argument. I don't know what it is. But I think that the point has been made that this is implicitly an argument against polygamy, maybe. I think it probably is if you already think polygamy is bad.
I might suggest that it's not an argument against polygamy, because a polygamist would probably say that he or she loves their multiple partners with their one soul, that they're with their entireness, so that one person can love more than one person with their whole soul, or, you know, dad or whatever, mind. So I don't know that it implies that the person is divided if they love two or three wives. I wouldn't have,
you may be right.
I don't know. Yeah.
I will not even try.
Does that term come up?
Well, you have an analogy.
You know, a polygamist doesn't love one wife with one hand and the other with the left.
How does polygamy work out in?
Okay, ladies and gentlemen, I think we'll call it a night here, and we will continue next time.